Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from A Search to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. This is the day we talk about the management of melanoma with Professor Georgina Long from the Melanoma Institute in Australia, the University of Sydney, in Sydney, New South Wales, Australia. We're really excited to be able to work with Professor Long today, and if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by her, just type them into the chat room. We'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do in all our webinars, we have a one-minute pre- and post-meeting survey for you to take. If you do this, you'll get a lot more out of what we're going to talk about here today. We're doing webinars all the time. We have been ever since the beginning of the pandemic. I'm taking a couple weeks off from doing webinars, but coming back on the 30th, we're doing one on BTK inhibitors in oncology, particularly in terms of toxicity. Then we're going over to the SOHO meeting in Houston, doing two satellites, but this is also going to be broadcast live. We're doing one on the September the 7th on myelofibrosis, and then another the next day, the 8th, on diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. We'll hear about CAR T, bispecifics, et cetera, et cetera. Monday, September 11th, we'll be talking about triple-negative breast cancer with Drs. Rugo and Trena. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Professor Hochschild on melanoma. But here we're here today to talk about melanoma. As mainly what we want to do is make rounds with Professor Long. And as we do in these programs, we have a bunch of docs in community-based practice who are going to be presenting cases here today. Here's sort of an overview of where we're heading. We're going to start out with a couple of papers from Professor Long, and then we'll go through the cases. Then we're going to take a look at a few data sets, and if we have time, we'll get into a bunch of other papers. We put a bunch of great data sets also in the appendix for you to check out. But Georgina, first of all, welcome. Great to work with you again. You know, it's funny, but you know, with these programs, I always go through people's CVs, their bios. And I do like 10 of those a week. And I was going through your bio, and I'm scrolling, and I'm still in 2023. And I've got to say, because we only pull the last 2 years of our faculty, you broke the record. Yours is 37 pages of just citations in the last couple of years. So first of all, I want to know how you do it. Do you have like a publishing house down there? How do you keep getting so much stuff out?
Well, first of all, I'm delighted to be here. I do love talking about the cancer I'm passionate about. That's melanoma. But look, we have an amazing team down here at Melanoma Institute Australia. We see so much melanoma. So that experience counts for a lot. We have a great translational lab, and I work very hard because I'm so passionate about it. That's all I can say, Neil. And we do a lot of trials. We have a very large trial unit, phase 1 to 3 trials, because we want to do better than the current more than 50% survival at 5 years in melanoma. We want to do better than that. So most of our patients, in fact, for us, most of our patients go on clinical trials if they're eligible.
Yeah, in one of the cases, I can't remember which one, the patient was diagnosed, I think, 14 years ago, and the doc was saying they got adjuvant interferon, and I was like, wow, yeah, things have changed a lot. All right, so before we start getting at all the cases and all the papers, I can't wait to hear about it, some of the new things. As happens not too infrequently in my life, I got an email about an hour ago from a doc who is in need. And I was thinking, well, maybe you could help her out. Okay. So just to get started, sure. Before we get started here, this is from she contributes to a lot of our programs. She's often in a chat room. She's from Roanoke, Virginia. Incidentally, welcome for the audience. I always think about the fact that you're in tomorrow. It's 6:30 a.m. on Friday for you. We're still on Thursday. Anyhow, so this is Dr. Padma Malady from Roanoke, Virginia, who wrote me, like I said, about an hour ago, said, I have a situation I encountered today. I initially thought there was a simple answer, but the more I talked to the person and heard about her anxiety, the more worried I got that maybe I'm missing something. And, you know, can you help out? Here's the bottom line. One of the young surgeons at her hospital came by to show an injury that she sustained during a procedure. Here's a picture of it. And what happened was, She was doing an abdominal surgery on a patient with metastatic colon cancer and doing a core needle biopsy. She did three passes, and on the third pass, it went through her finger. And she is completely panicked about the possibility that, you know, she doesn't know what the biopsy showed, but there's plenty of cancer in this patient's abdomen, that somehow it's going to get into her finger. Literally was so panicked, was talking to Dr. Malady about looking into amputating the end of her finger. So I know you're into the biology of cancer and metastasis. I thought maybe you could help out. Any thoughts?
Absolutely. I would not be worried about getting cancer from that. I'd be more worried about infectious diseases and doing all the regular things we'd normally do with a needle stick injury, even though it's a core biopsy injury. So, you know, HIV, Hep B, Hep C, I would go down that standard protocolized pathway. But in terms of cancer, we know that the immune system in a very fit and healthy person is very robust. So if this person has a robust immune system, and I'm sure if she's working as a younger doc doing core biopsies, she's fit and well, our immune system can deal with foreign material like that. Think of it as a true foreign material. This is a cancer from another person. It's not going to be HLA matched. It's not like you're a transplant patient where you get a transplanted kidney and it's matched, HLA matched, etc. And then you're immunosuppressed. This is not that situation. So in a robust person with a good immune system, I would not be too concerned. I'd be more concerned about infectious diseases. However, if they want further reassurance, talking with a good immunologist would be another way to get reassurance. But I would not be concerned that this person will develop colorectal cancer from a core biopsy in their finger with a robust immune system. It will be rejected pretty quickly.
Yeah, no,
we also have data just on that. Placenta crossing melanoma, placental crossing of melanoma into a fetus.
Right.
And that's extraordinarily rare. And it's rejected by the fetus. So our immune systems are pretty keyed up. The only reason our immune systems accept our own cancers is that they're usually quite well matched to our, you know, HLA, MHC1, MHC2, antigen presentation, etc. So I would not be concerned in this situation, but discussing that with your immunology and your transplant colleagues, actually, that's where that data is well known, but I would not be concerned.
So, yeah, she did go to the health office and checked out all the other things that needed to be checked out. All right, well, let's get down to the nitty-gritty here in terms of melanoma. And I want to start out with just a few papers that you did, and we have a bunch of other ones later. But first of all, I just want to alert people, you know, the Lancet is always, every now and then, they do review articles on major topics that are really maybe more oriented to non-oncologists, but have a lot of great content. And you were the one who did the melanoma one just recently this year. I'm just putting it there for people to know about and check out, because like all these review articles in Lancet, it's an awesome article. But here's what I want to start out with, which is the issue that, you know, I remember talking to you about this before. You were super excited about it, but it kind of wasn't quite ready for prime time. Neoadjuvant immunotherapy with checkpoint inhibitors. And I see a couple papers here. The time is now. Neoadjuvant immunotherapy for melanoma is now ready for clinical practice. I was like, why don't you just say what you think, Georgina? But anyhow, let's talk a little bit, you know, just sort of, again, without slides, just, you know, your own vision for immunotherapy and right now where you think it fits in.
I'll start with right now and then I'll go to my vision, if I may, Neil. Right now we have a well-accumulated good evidence that neoadjuvant immunotherapy improves outcomes for patients more so than adjuvant therapy. So historically what we first saw is we started with BRAF-MEC neoadjuvant. We saw a nice correlation, so BRAF-targeted therapy, a nice correlation with complete pathological response and relapse-free survival, which are very similar to the breast cancer world. But then when we were working with neoadjuvant immunotherapy, we saw a different pattern. Not only did complete pathological response correlate nicely with relapse-free survival, but we saw near complete pathological response, so 10% or less of the tumor remaining after 6 weeks of neoadjuvant immunotherapy, or even a partial pathological response, which is 50% or less of tumor remaining in the tumor bed after 6 weeks of immunotherapy. Both those categories of pathological response did just as well as complete pathological response. So we went, this is really interesting. So we were getting a different sort of outcome. Then when we looked at mouse models, this was published back in 2016, neoadjuvant therapy was doing better than adjuvant. And then in a pilot study where ipi-nivo or CTLA-4 anti-PD-1 was given either neoadjuvantly or adjuvantly, we saw much higher increase in T-cell clones against the tumor when given neoadjuvantly. And then the final piece in the puzzle, and we did a pooled analysis showing you what I just described with BRAF versus immunotherapy. But then the final piece in the puzzle was the randomized phase 2 trial conducted across the US, SWOG trial, showing that neoadjuvant single agent anti-PD-1 improved the event-free survival, and I'll describe that as an outcome, by 42% actually improvement compared with adjuvant pembrolizumab. Same drug, same doses, same patients randomized, simply giving 3 doses before the surgery. So that really demonstrated with all those bits of evidence that immunotherapy is different to things like chemo and targeted therapy in the neoadjuvant space. Checkpoint inhibitors specifically, we're not talking intralesional. They do not do the same thing as checkpoints. They're a bit more like targeted therapy in that you can only really count on the complete response, and even then you get recurrences. Checkpoint inhibitor therapies are different. They seem to do work better when they can see the enemy, the tumor, and regardless of the pathological response category, patients get a benefit. So either partial, near complete, or complete. We're now just finishing off a phase 3 trial with ipilimumab and nivolumab versus adjuvant nivolumab, and that's called the NADINA trial. And once that's finished, we'll have our phase 3 data. And the reason we're doing that trial is that we see a much higher pathological response with the combination compared with pembrolizumab alone. Now, we haven't seen that SWOG data yet in detail, the pathological response breakdown. In the SWOG randomized trial of pembro neoadjuvant, we've actually only seen the event-free survival. We haven't seen the pathological response. And the pathological response category is so important for a clinician. Why? Patients need to know what category they fit in. Am I in the pathological non-responder? Because they don't do as well. You have to keep your scans up every 3 months after surgery. If they're a complete or near complete responder, so that's a major pathological response, we can stretch out the scans. We know the chance of recurrence is much, much less than 5%, 5 in 100. So not only do we need to know, yes, the event-free survival is improved, and that includes the relapse-free survival, but we also need to know the response category, the pathological response category, because that will change what we do after surgery. We can stretch out scans, we might even change the adjuvant part, or we can not have any adjuvant therapy.
So before you tell us where you think right now you would use neoadjuvant therapy.
Okay, right now.
Before you do that, I was just going to say, sometimes people say things to me and it dislodges memories from long ago. And I was just thinking, you know who the first person was that I did a interview with? Was a doc by the name of Dr. Bernard Fisher. In breast cancer fame, you may know that was sort of the father of breast.
Yes.
But his whole thing based on laboratory research was that neoadjuvant treatment would give better long-term outcome, but yet the trial showed exactly the same long-term outcome whether you gave it neoadjuvant or not. But now this is the first time I remember seeing neoadjuvant looking better than adjuvant in any cancer. chat room, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I remember seeing that. Granted, it was only phase two. The other thing I was thinking about is I haven't seen data like that in lung cancer. I was thinking, like, where else are they using IO adjuvantly? And you're seeing a lot of that now in non-small cell lung cancer, neoadjuvant, adjuvant. But I don't think there's a trial doing what you all did, which is compare neoadjuvant to adjuvant in lung. So just really interesting. So let's just finish out with what are the, there may be a couple of cases we're presenting here where you'd use neoadjuvant. I'm curious about that.
Yeah.
But in what situations right now would you use neoadjuvant immunotherapy? And what do you think we're going to be doing in 2 or 3 years?
Great question. So I would use it in stage 3 clinically detected lymphadenopathy or lymph node disease. Clinically detected does not mean you can palpate it necessarily. Even if you can see it on a scan, then I would be, and it's stage 3 and resectable. We have to remember melanoma surgery, it's not in anatomical difficult places. We're not talking about the esophagus. We're not talking about breasts where you want anatomical conservation often. So we are not doing neoadjuvant therapy for easier surgery. And that's important. That's not why we're doing it. So don't just reach for it when you think, oh, this is borderline resectable. Our surgeons are going to struggle, because actually immunotherapy makes it a little more sticky. It does make it a bit more sticky in there when you're operating. This is about improving overall or event-free survival. So this is not something just for big disease or difficult to resect disease. This is about improving outcomes. So any measurable or clinically detected stage 3 melanoma, that's the time to think about neoadjuvant therapy. You can consider it in stage 4, but technically that's just like treating stage 4 anyway. You just don't have this, you don't need the surgery necessarily. So that's where I'd treat it now. I would wait for the data on the combination. In the data in the Nadina phase 3 trial, we're using small dose ipilimumab, 1 mg/kg and 3 mg/kg of nivolumab. So it's a little better tolerated than the full dose we use in stage 4 of the combination. But wait for that data, because the pathological response rate is much, much higher with the combination. In fact, 75% versus about 40% for PD-1 alone. So let's wait for that data. I think we're going to be pushing out the outcome data to much better stats with that combination. And one last comment. Where do I think we're going? That's really important vision-wise. I think in the future, patients will walk in. This is far in the future, but some of it's going to be in the next few years. Patient will walk in with their melanoma. We're now doing a neoadjuvant study in stage 2 melanoma, so without lymph node disease, just the primary intact. But patients will walk in, they'll get their biopsy. We will risk stratify for recurrence. If you're not going to recur, you're off, you go, see you later, you just have your surgery. If your predictor, molecular and clinical, you have to use both, predicts for recurrence, we then decide what treatment will be best for you. If it's a standard checkpoint inhibitor immunotherapy, you'll get that. If not, in the medium term, we'll put you on clinical trials where we're enriching for people predicted not to respond to standard. And in the future, I think we'll be able to select the drugs a lot better for patients who are predicted not to recur. And it'll be neoadjuvant.
So a lot of questions coming in the chat room. Swati wants to know, do you use some kind of risk calculator to predict recurrence rate in the adjuvant setting? Nicholas says he thinks neoadjuvant therapy in bladder is better than adjuvant. I'm not sure if it's the same kind of data that we just saw that we were just talking about. Ankit wants to know about neoadjuvant therapy in mucosal melanoma. We saw a paper on mucosal at ASCO. And I want to know, what did you mean when you said immunotherapy makes it more sticky? Because like I've heard the neoadjuvant therapy in lung cancer, they say, no, the surgery is the same. What do you mean it's like stickier there?
So all of the clinical trials we've done, we actually ask this patient, there's a lot of questions there. First of all, the risk calculator, I'll deal with some of them quickly. Risk calculator, yes. If you go to melanomarisk.org.au, we have a suite of risk calculators. The adjuvant one is coming. So we will have an adjuvant risk calculator. We also have a risk of recurrence calculator for early stage melanoma. We'll have one for stage two melanoma. So all of those calculators are coming, melanomarisk.org.au. The question you asked about sticky, I'll go to that because it's the top of my head. So in all our trials, we ask our surgeons before, and we've published on that in our BRAF-MEC original, that's 2013 trial we started back then, but we now have a international neoadjuvant melanoma consortium, and we publish white papers on the pooled analysis where we compared BRAF and immunotherapy. We've published a white paper on how to conduct clinical trials in the neoadjuvant setting so that we could make sure we're all doing similar things around the world so we can pull our data. That way we get to patients quicker because we change outcomes and then change standard therapy. And then the other one is surgical assessment. And in that white paper, we've put a questionnaire that we ask the surgeons before surgery and after surgery. How do they predict the surgery will go? And then what was their actual experience? And it's interesting. With BRAF-MEC, most of the time, more than 50% of the time, the surgery is actually easier than they predicted. For immunotherapy, most of the time, it's the same, just as you said, Neil, or a little more difficult. And the difficulty is because of the immune reaction, and it's more difficult, the better the response, because we know pathologically, and Richard Scollier, he's the preeminent pathologist in melanoma across the world, editor of The Who. He's led the neoadjuvant assessment with Mike Tetzlaff in melanoma. And what they see is if you see fibrosis, the laying down of fibrotic tissue within that 6 weeks of neoadjuvant therapy, those patients do particularly well. And that's how we know the partial responders. If we see fibrosis or hyalinized fibrosis in the pathological specimen, those partial responders are going to do brilliantly long term. And it's that fibrosis which makes it sticky for the surgeon. But ask any melanoma surgeon who's done a lot of neoadjuvant and they'll tell you, yeah. And the more sticky it is, the better the outcome for the patient, because that's that fibrosis.
Actually, you can ask Dr. Kumar in the chat room, because while you were talking, he was at the same time saying one of his urologists says that after immunotherapy, the operation is more difficult because of fibrosis. So he was saying that were talking, incidentally. Interesting. Yeah. So one more thing I've got to ask you about. Right.
Sorry, keep going.
I want to get to the cases, but I've got to ask you about this RNA vaccine that just got reported at ASCO. It was really mind-blowing, particularly when I saw the name Moderna associated with it. So this was an incredible randomized phase two study that you all reported, adding this mRNA vaccine with neoantigens at 34 targets individualized to the patient. Again, phase two, but the data looked positive. But I'm just more curious, how does this thing work?
Fantastic. Again, a great topic. It's interesting. So we started working with Moderna back in 2018 before COVID. And this trial was a tiny little trial. We were actually joined quite late, so put a lot of patients on at the late part of it in 2019. And then COVID hit and Moderna pivots. And then they go and do their COVID thing. And then after COVID, we now live with COVID, they've now come back, and people don't realize that. So the relationship with the cancer world and the Moderna company, where it only had 150 employees, started long before COVID. So this is a project pre-COVID. It is phenomenal. When we think about history and all the great things that have happened, we know the World Wide Web is a major improvement in our quality of life. Electricity, going from candles to electricity, all the great, huge improvements in cancer therapy for us in melanoma, immune therapy, checkpoint inhibitors is a huge fork in the road for management. First time we actually improve survival in advanced melanoma. Well, I think the mRNA technology for medicine is a very similar, huge, huge improvement, because this will not just affect cancer, but it can affect so many other diseases in medicine. But the way it works is you take the patient's tumor, you sequence the tumor, and using particular, they've got great algorithms. There's some available online, by the way, that you can just use the software, you can identify using the genomics, so the DNA, but also the RNA helps as well. You can identify what proteins are being expressed that are unique to that individual's tumor, and they are just for that individual's tumor. We all know solid tumors are very heterogeneous. If you don't have a heterogeneous tumor, well, it's not a cancer. And so what we're doing is selecting out what's unique to that individual's cancer. We then sequence that, and there are some ways to predict what are the proteins expressed that are the most immunogenic for that patient, knowing that patient's HLA class or MHC1 and MHC2. That's how we present foreign material to our immune system. And then with that immunogenicity score, you choose the top, in this case, 34 neoantigens. That's what they're called, individual proteins expressed by that cancer. You sequence them and you put them into the vaccine. So you put that sequence, mRNA sequence, into the mRNA vaccine. You cover it in lipid and you inject it as a vaccine. What happens is that that then gets taken up by cells, and then those antigens get presented to the immune system in your MHC class 1 or 2, and then that stimulates the immune system against those novel proteins. That's the concept. It's about stimulating your own immune system against your neoantigens. And sure enough, in this phase 2 study, the red curve there being the personalized vaccine combined with checkpoint inhibitor versus checkpoint inhibitor alone, we see a significant improvement. It's one-sided alpha though, but significant improvement in the relapse-free survival. That phase 3 trial is now ongoing in stage 2B, right up to resected stage 4, adjuvant trial of personalized vaccine plus checkpoint versus checkpoint alone. And I think we'll get faster at it. I mean, it takes a few weeks to develop it. I think Moderna are getting much, much faster at it. I think we can start to do it in as short 3 to 4 weeks, produce a vaccine. I think it's really the way to go.
So, yeah, I mean, again, randomized phase 2 with this curve here that we're seeing that you just showed with recurrence-free survival, hazard rate of 0.56, and then metastasis-free survival has a rate of 0.34. So very interesting. As you say, seems to be very well tolerated. Presented some data on cell-free DNA. We could talk a lot about that. All right, let's go through some cases and make some rounds after that exciting partial view of what's going on in melanoma. You can't even get through the new stuff in an hour. We tried that a couple weeks ago. But okay, let's talk about taking care of patients. I love this first case. So, let me just tell you before you hear the doc. A patient presents with painfully inflamed ears. So painful, like immobilizing, requiring terrible, red, painful ears. And is, when workup is found to have metastatic melanoma that's BRAF mutant. The thinking is that this is some kind of paraneoplastic syndrome. You're going to hear her describe it, but I want to just ask you about this scenario first because, you know, everybody wants to know about what do you do with BRAF mutant metastatic disease, but this is a pretty wild case because you talk about symptomatic. This patient was really symptomatic. So first of all, before you hear the case, any thoughts?
When you say paraneoplastic, quite rare in melanoma, actually, to be honest. Retinopathies we can get, but they're very, very rare. In my whole career, and I see a lot of patients a week, I've seen paraneoplasm plastic syndrome about once. Very rare. So that's the first thought.
Have you seen
the second thought?
Have you seen anybody with painful red ears in your career?
Nope, I have not.
Okay.
But then the second thought is, interesting. This is showing me an immune sort of activation, which we see a lot in melanoma, that for decades we've known, that melanoma has a really interesting relationship with the immune system. So I'm already thinking immune-related issue with having cancer. Whether you term it paraneoplastic or not, that's what I think.
Well, that's interesting. All right, so here's the actual case. I'm curious what you think about it. Go ahead.
One more thing. It's bilateral. So often us oncs think, is a symptom due to cancer, as in, you know, a solid bit of cancer, tumor-growing pain, this is weird because it's bilateral inflamed red ears. So that's odd. There we go.
Yeah. Well, I just, first of all, I can congratulate Dr. Metzger-Sidorsky of having a patient as some that you haven't seen, but here's the case.
He presented with bilateral red ears, and they were horribly inflamed, red, painful. He have seen primary and was treated with antibiotics twice. He saw ENT. They put him on steroids. PET scan showed that he has metastatic disease. He was BRAF positive, but because he had this inflamed ears and I needed a fast response, he was so painful. He couldn't, he only was laying like this in his bed because he said if the ear touched the pillow, he was crying and he required narcotics. So I went with ipilimumab and nivolumab, and 2 weeks after the treatment, his ears were better.
Wow.
And so he finished the four cycles of ipilimumab, nivolumab, and his PET scan is already better.
Wow.
And the question I have to the panel is, autoimmune presentation like this, paraneoplastic, does it respond better to immunotherapy? Is there any data for it? And is it a mistake that I did go with immunotherapy?
Yeah, that's what really I wanted to ask you was, would you use a BRAF or immunotherapy in, you know, this very symptomatic patient? I thought she was pretty courageous to do ipi-nivo when a patient was suffering, but, and it's kind of almost funny that she's saying, did I make the right decisions? Patient's in CR a year later. Any thoughts about this case?
I think she did the absolute right thing. I would have done the same. The inflamed ears would have been more encouragement for me for the reasons I just discussed with you. That is, there's some activation of the immune system here. We just need to push it along a bit more. And the pain, and she was right clinically, everything's in the history. We know that 90% of the diagnosis and the issues are in the history. She was right to connect the pain with the cancer. And then say, I need to control the cancer. We know from the DreamSeq data that giving immunotherapy up front versus BRAF-MEK is better. You could have used BRAF-MEK as a bridge if you'd wanted to, but that sometimes that can confuse the issue. The patient didn't have a lot of disease. You saw from the PET scan, that wasn't a huge amount. I think she did the right thing, and it turns out she did do the right thing with the retroscope. And us medicos have to get used to owning our decisions, and sometimes we don't make the right decision, but we do our very best. But that was the right decision, and I would have done the same, and I would have clued on to the fact that the pain is inflammatory. We've got an opportunity here. There's activation of the immune system. In terms of data and paraneoplastic syndrome and better outcomes, we just don't see enough of it to be able to say. But hypothetically, her thinking was exactly as we would, I would think too. Great case.
Yeah, I brought up this issue when IOs first came out in the small cell. I was asking people what's going to happen with paraneoplastic, but I don't think, again, I don't know if there are enough of them that you can even say. All right, let's dip our toe into the adjuvant waters, so to speak. Dr. Moon has a 73-year-old man, BRAF wild type, so not you don't have BRAF as an option. But one of the things that this case brings up also is the issue of how much steroids bothers you in giving an IO. This is a man who had COPD. And he would require oral steroids on occasion to control that, but mostly inhaled treatment. Here's the case.
73-year-old Caucasian male, diabetes, hypertension, a touch of COPD that's well controlled on oral meds and then some inhaled steroids. He has several skin cancer before. The dermatologist actually picked this up. There was this nodule on his left shoulder, and you see that left lot because of the driving, right? So the lesion was biopsied, thought to be melanoma, had the appropriate oncology-directed resection, which is quite large, and the sentinel lymph node biopsy. Ultimately, he had a T2A lesion, which is not very big nor deep, but he had 2 out of 3 of the lymph node in the sentinel area that's positive for melanoma. He was BRAF negative.
So what's the follow-up on the patient?
He actually ultimately did undergo 1 year of pembrolizumab. There was some consideration about side effects, especially with COPD. He was not very much steroid, so we thought it would be effective.
Any questions you'd like to hear Professor Long discuss in terms of adjuvant therapy?
Would you send this person back to get out more lymph nodes? Would she, number one, offer any immunotherapy at all? And number two, would she go with doublet versus a single agent?
And number three from me is, how much do steroids bother you when you're given a checkpoint inhibitor? Any thoughts?
Yes. First of all, he does not need more surgery. We know from the MSLT2 data that therapeutic lymph node dissection in central node positive patients does not improve overall survival. So central node procedure is a wonderful staging procedure. And this obviously helped Dr. Moon because she was dealing with a 2A primary, and then knowing the central node status helped her increase his risk of, think about his risk of recurrence. So no need to do more surgery to answer that question. Would have I given pembrolizumab? A few things. Steroids do worry me for immune checkpoint inhibitor. Small amounts, small period of time, not too concerned. But people on large amounts of steroids, chronically higher doses, when I say higher doses, I mean more than 10 milligrams. We have good mouse data. We get good clinical data to show that corticosteroids are bad, not only for cancer, but for immune checkpoint inhibitors. So patients who get toxicity and then we treat with lots and lots of immunosuppression, they don't do as well as they had not got that toxicity because of the steroids. So that answers that. Would have I given him pembrolizumab? I think having a discussion with this patient is reasonable. I agree with Dr. Moon. Having two lymph nodes with cancer cells in them, it makes me think, oh, this is stage 3A plus. The other thing that makes me think stage 3A plus, when I think that in my head, is when I see high mitoses in the primary. Now, we don't know in this patient whether there were high mitoses, but they're the cases where I go, oh, this is 3A with a bit more oomph behind it in terms of risk of recurrence. I would have had the same discussion with the patient. I would have happily not treated this patient as well, because we know that when melanoma recurs, we still can cure. I use the word carefully as a medical oncologist, but we can cure later. So it would have been just a discussion with the patient and their view on recurrence and living with the risk of recurrence versus doing something now. I would have happily not treated this patient, but at the same time, happily treated them. And then the last question was, I can't remember now. There was another question that we had. Can you remember, Neil? Well, did I answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. Well, while I'm thinking about any other questions, incidentally, in the chat room, Dillips, getting back to the ear thing, says, could this be hypertrophic steatoarthropathy involving the ears? Just put that aside. So first of all, I want to ask you, she made this comment, which I never thought about the left arm, you know, being in the window, so to speak. Do you see more melanoma in the left arm?
So in Australia, it's on the right arm because we drive on the other side
right,
of the road.
Right, we do.
And that's the other point I was going to make. There are some clinical characteristics of melanoma primaries that make me think they're more immune therapy sensitive. And one of them are the primaries that arise in very chronically sun-damaged areas. They have higher tumor mutation burden. Now, tumor mutation burden is a blunt instrument. It's correlated with being responsive to immune checkpoints, but it's that same concept, more neoantigens, more ability to be seen by the immune system. So that factor, yes, we do see more melanomas in sun-damaged areas. For us, it's the right side, right face, right arm. And that would be another reason to say, oh, well, maybe a year of anti-PD-1. Or then the other question Dr. Moon asked was whether I'd use doublet. No, I would not. It's not approved. It's not tested. We know from BMS 915 adjuvant trial, ipi-nevo versus nevo, there was no difference. However, having said that, don't be put off by CTLA-4 in stage 4. The dosing in that trial was, in simple words, pathetic. It was 1 milligram per kilogram every 8 weeks. That is not enough. We know that CTLA-4 is important for those really hard to treat, no TILs there in baseline, no tumor infiltrating lymphocytes. It is a really important drug for that group of patients, but you need to dose it. And we know there's a dose response curve with anti-CTLA-4 that we don't have with anti-PD-1. And we also see a toxicity response curve with anti-CTLA-4. But in this case, I would not give combination. But just because BMS-915 adjuvant trial was negative, please don't write off anti-CTLA-4. It is a crucial drug for the hard-to-treat cancers. It really is important, and it works at a different point in the immune system.
I think we're going to have a part two for this webinar, another additional hour. I'm getting so many great questions and cases, and we're not even getting through these. But I wanted to ask you where things are. You know, we've been checking in with you all over the last few years about adjuvant therapy. This patient was BRAF wild type, but it's been a pretty interesting discussion the last few years about adjuvant therapy and BRAF mutant disease. I feel like when I talk to investigator, it kind of goes back and forth. People are worried about, you know, diabetes and irreversible problems with IOs, but they see the DreamSeq and they think, well, maybe IOs are better. What's your current thought? Are you, I know you're generally an immunotherapy advocate. Are there situations where you use adjuvant dab-trem?
There sure are. And we have to remember the COMBI-AD data of dabrafenib, trametinib, in stage 3 resected melanoma. It was a very great, it's a great relapse-free survival benefit. And an early look, we saw an overall survival. The curves were splitting. The p-value was like less than 0.00001, but it hadn't crossed the pre-specified boundary. So watch this space for the overall survival data. So there is a role for BRAF and MEK. Yes, we carry the biases from advanced melanoma. You're right, Neil. We do see higher landmark survivals with immune checkpoints. We assume that that will be the case in adjuvant as well. But we can't forget that BRAF MEK does work and can cure early stage melanoma. So the times we use it is when patients have contraindications to immunotherapy and have high risk stage 3 resected disease. That's a good place to work, use it. And also patients who are very afraid of toxicities from the immunotherapies. We have to remember, yes, there are some irreversible endocrinopathies. The thyroid, not a big issue. It really is not difficult to manage. Hyperphysitis, that's or secondary adrenalism, that's a little more difficult for patients in terms of getting their energy levels right. The real killer is the type 1 diabetes, but that's about 8 to 10 people in a 1,000. So it's not very common. But when it does happen, it is a pain for patients. So no, BRAF-MEK has its role. It's a discussion with the patient. But we do carry some of the biases in terms of the long-term landmarks from stage 4 into the adjuvant setting. The other thing is dab-trem's not easy to give. Luckily, it doesn't have irreversible toxicities, but a lot of patients struggle through it for the 12 months with the fevers.
So I was chatting with a professor long before we got started and mentioning to her, I know it's a completely different cancer, but kind of interesting that the ADAURA adjuvant osimertinib data in lung cancer was presented at ASCO. Initially, they had just disease-free survival. A lot of people were thinking they weren't going to see any survival benefit. You can always treat them on relapse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they just presented survival, hazard rate of 0.5. I mean, major survival benefit. So maybe we need to think about adjuvant-targeted therapy a little bit differently. Here's another case. It's really kind of interesting case. Dr. Brenner has of a patient who he keeps treating with pembrolizumab, he keeps responding, he stops, he recurs again. Here's the case.
This is a 58-year-old male I've been following for many years. He initially presented almost 14 years ago with a stage 3 melanoma. At that time, he had surgical resection, and we actually treated him back then with adjuvant interferon, which was difficult, but he was able to get through all the treatment. Unfortunately, relapsed about 2 years later with predominantly in-transit skin and subcutaneous metastases in his right leg, which were treated with surgical resection as well as radiation therapy. He then developed progressive subcutaneous metastases outside of his right leg and then received single-agent pembrolizumab. And after about 16 months of therapy, had a complete remission, and we discontinued therapy, gave him a treatment break. He relapsed about 2 years later, again with multifocal subcutaneous biopsy-proven metastases, and then we reinitiated therapy with pembrolizumab. He again went into a complete remission that was discontinued after a year, and unfortunately relapsed again with disease involving his right inner lip, as well as numerous other subcutaneous metastases. And at that time, he was initiated on therapy with nivolumab and relatlimab, which he's on currently at this time, tolerating well. My question for the clinical investigators is, in patients who achieve a complete remission to IO-based therapy, should we stop therapy? And if we do stop therapy, after how many cycles? When should we use a dual checkpoint IO therapy versus nivolumab relatlimab? He just had his first follow-up PET scan, and he's had a partial response.
Really?
Huh. Yeah.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, lots of thoughts. There's so much to discuss in that case. First of all, there are a bunch of patients. It's actually not that common. There are a bunch of patients that can achieve a complete response, and then you stop therapy and then they recur or progress. It's not that common. Most patients, the standard 2-year treatment for checkpoint inhibitor is empiric. It's only that we did that in clinical trials. Most patients who have their 2-year course and have a good response, partial or complete, tend not to recur once you stop. The majority do not, especially the complete responders. However, there is a small bunch of patients. I have a bunch of them. I can name them, and I see a lot of patients where they have a great response. Then you stop treatment, and then things start to grow, usually in the first 9 months, anytime in that first 9 months. Then you retreat them, it shrinks again. In fact, I have about 5 patients now where they're just on continuous checkpoint inhibitor and have been for 5-6 years, because every time I stop, it grows again. But every time I reintroduce it, it shrinks again. So I think it's unusual, this case, but it demonstrates a small subpopulation that just need lifelong anti-PD-1. One of my fellows has liver mets, and every time I stop it, his liver mets grow and become more active on PET. And then I start it, they shrink. Another woman has lymphadenopathy, and another woman has subcutaneous disease, very similar. But I can think of these patients. They're unusual. The other thing to say, just on the PET scan, I wanted to make a comment on that. We've shown, we've had 2 publications now, that in these circumstances where you've been on immunotherapy or checkpoint inhibitors for a long period of time and you're deciding whether to stop, let's say 2 years is our standard treatment. Let's say you're deciding, should I stop this patient at 1 year or 18 months? I normally don't, unless the patient's pushing or they're elderly and they just don't want to come in for the infusion and they've had a great response early, like a really good deep response within the first 12 to 18 weeks, then I stop early for that patient if they're elderly, et cetera. But a PET scan's really important. You may have a resist partial response, so you've got shrinkage, but you still can see the nub of metastases. But if they have a complete metabolic response, that patient behaves the same as a resist complete response. And we've published on that 2 papers. Aaron Tan's the first author. He was a fellow of ours years ago. And then the update on that was Florentia Dimitriou, who was another fellow of ours from Zurich. Both those papers show that a metabolic response, complete metabolic response, even if it's a partial resist response, do the same as a complete resist response. So you can safely stop them. Now, this patient that Dr. Brennan just presented still has a partial response on PET. So I would continue treatment. How long? I just do it empiric, 2 years, just keeping in mind there's a tiny, tiny, tiny subgroup of patients that need much longer. And then there is a subgroup of patients that you can stop early if they have a great response, early deep response, and want to stop, or for toxicities. So that's the summary for that case, I feel.
So, Georgina, do you know where Brewer, Maine is? Anyhow, I know you don't. But anyhow, Dr. Phil Brooks. Hey, Phil, good to see you. Phil's been participating in our programs for a long time. He wants to know, what about MRD testing like Signatera to help decide when to stop immunotherapy? Any thoughts about that? And then Swati, another doc in the chat room, wants to know, what about ENCO-BINI in the adjuvant setting?
Okay, so to address the first question, circulating tumor DNA, wonderful tool It's a tool. We don't yet have the data to answer that specific question. We do know that those who have zero conversion, so you have circulating tumor DNA positive at baseline and at zero converts, do much better long term. We know that. But whether that can be used to stop therapy, I would put it in my mind the same as a scan. It's another tool. It's great. It suggests you probably could, but we don't know yet, because there may be some patients, just like Dr. Brennan's patients, that you see a great scan or you see a great zero conversion on circulating tumor DNA, but they may recur later and you need to continue treatment. I think it's a wonderful tool. I think we should be using it and collecting data on what it means for our patients in large populations. So watch this space and go from there. The second question was the adjuvant encorafenib, binimetinib. We do not have any adjuvant data for that combination. There is a trial ongoing in stage 2B and 2C resected melanoma. So if you do have patients that are 2B, 2C resected, it's placebo controlled and they're a little concerned about toxicity with pembrolizumab, or they have a contraindication but would like to have treatment, a clinical trial is the best way to go. It's called Columbus AD. It's on the clinical trials website and there are sites around the world. So I recommend that for patients with stage 2B, 2C, resected, who are BRAF mutant.
So let's go into another case. This is a patient of Dr. Rudolph, a 74-year-old man. Dr. Brenner was asking about relatlimab, nivolumab, which his patient was responding to. This patient was actually on a trial of that in the adjuvant setting and relapse. Here's the case.
74-year-old gentleman with BRAF V600K mutated, initial presentation with a stage 3 melanoma in his right upper back. He went on into the clinical trial, nivolumab versus nivolumab and relatlimab. It was a blinded study, but subsequently found out that he was getting the relatlimab as well. He was two cycles into treatment and had significant recurrent orthostatic hypotension. He could not even just get up and walk. His blood pressure would drop. He had an extensive cardiac evaluation. And at the end of all of that, it was chalked to be secondary to his immunotherapy. So he was taken off the trial because he was just too symptomatic. And oddly enough, when we did stop his nivo-relatlimab, his symptoms completely disappeared. So he was switched to treatment with pembrolizumab off trial and was tolerated it extremely well without any side effects. However, a few months down the road, new dermal mets with uptake, and there was also lung nodules with uptake in those lung nodules. I switched him to treatment with ipilimumab and nivolumab. However, after cycle 3, he started having a rapid progression of these dermal mets. I recently switched him to treatment with encorafenib and binimetinib. He is currently hospitalized as we speak. He came in with fever 102 to 104 on encobini. So he's undergoing workup. He does not have any obvious source of fever. So it's probably medication related. Would love to know how the experts make their choices for BRAF mutated melanoma.
So I'm sure there are a thousand things you could talk about there. But the first thing I want to ask you about is, I never heard of orthostatic hypotension in immunotherapy. Is that a reality?
I think it could be. We know that there are common toxicities from our immune checkpoint inhibitors. But then we know, and I say this to every patient, any organ, any tissue in your body can be affected. So I'm wondering if there's an autonomic issue here. We've seen that occasionally. We've seen phrenic nerves being selectively impacted. So they get the paradoxical breathing. That's very troublesome.
Wow.
Yes, it's very, very rare. But I would put this in the category, without knowing the detail, of course, what's been worked up, what tests have been done to prove it, but I'd put this in the category of a neuropathy. What's interesting, though, is, and I'd have to ask Dr. Rudolph, how quickly did this patient get better from this orthostatic problem? Did you have to give any immune suppression? Doesn't sound like it. So that fact about it makes me wonder, well, was it truly one of those neurotoxicities? Because those tend to need treatment with checkpoint inhibitors. So very unusual. My thought is a possible neurotox, but I'd love to know more. Does that answer your question, Neil?
Yeah, the other thing I was going to ask you about is how do you manage, obviously the issue of BRAF mutant metastatic disease is very important. There are tons of questions in the chat room about it. Everybody refers to the DREAMseq study in terms of that. But what about the patient who's had prior adjuvant IO? Do you look at them differently? Are you still pulling out the ipi-nivo when you can? Do you look at it differently, or do you go to BRAF?
If there are no contraindications, I pull out the ipi-nivo first. And that's because if you go the BRAF-MEK first and then they develop resistance, it's harder to treat with immunotherapy. And there's good data to show you do change the microenvironment. Even in our ABC trial of ipi-nivo versus nivo in brain metastases, that's the only randomized trial showing that the ipi-nivo is so much more active. We had 8 patients who'd had prior BRAF-MEK in that trial and went on to ipi-nivo, and only one of them responded. And there's countless other studies like that. Whereas if you get the patients up front, you see a much higher response rate. So there is good data to say go with your immuno just because you've still left your powder dry for your BRAF-MEK. Whereas if you do it the reverse, it's harder to try the ipi-nivo later. But that case that Dr. Rudolph just presented, that's a heart sink case. When I get cases like that, they're going to be tough to treat. You're going to treat with BRAF-MEK until you get resistance. Occasionally, you'll see patients not develop resistance, but the patients that blow through, I use that term, progress through treatments quickly, they're likely to do that with the BRAF-MEK as well. So it is what I call a heart sink case. I think, this poor patient. And now on top of that, they're getting fevers on encorafenib, binimetinib. How do we make a choice between our BRAF-MEK? So to answer that question of Dr. Rudolph's, generally encobini is the best tolerated. Dabrafenib, trametinib usually is associated with a much higher fever rate. But all you can do in those situations is try another doublet and just find which is the best tolerated. And the other thing is steroids. Corticosteroids ameliorate almost all of the side effects for any combination you choose, whether it be Dabtram or Encobini.
Yeah, I was struck by the fact this patient had a fever, 102, 104. I don't know how sick the patient was. He was, put in the hospital. But I mean, I think if that patient was on Dabtram, you just give him steroids and, okay. Would you have done the same thing with this patient? Just give you not, just assume it's from the Encobini. Have you seen temps like that from Encobini?
It's rare. It's not common at all, but you can. And just as Dr. Rudolph had said, that excluded anything else. You've got to, in this situation, Encobini, we don't see fevers a lot. You can, though, exclude everything else, look for other sources of infection, et cetera, and then put it down to the drug. But it is a diagnosis of exclusion when you see it for the first time on Encobini. And I often would then stop the Encobini or the Dabtram, whichever's causing it, wait for it to resolve, and then I re-challenge before I consider prophylactic corticosteroids. Often you may only get it a few times and then it just dissipates and patients tolerate the treatment. But if they're getting recurrent fevers, that's when I then introduce prophylactic corticosteroids.
So incidentally, Dr. Rudolph's in the chat room. She said the orthostatic hypertension got better right away. All right, I'm going to see if I can squeeze in one more case because I'm really curious how you might think this one through. It's another patient of Dr. Moon's, a 36-year-old woman. Here's what happened.
This is a 36-year-old Caucasian female. She was a teacher. History of melanoma in situ, and has a family history of melanoma. She actually was vacation. She went to Disneyland, and she had this small lump in her axilla. And she's, in retrospect, she told me, you know, she was obviously very fearful of the idea of melanoma because she had a sister that may have had a same story. The primary care ordered appropriately a mammogram, and eventually, because of this family history of melanoma, got a CT chest, abdomen, pelvis, and it actually showed that there was quite a large cluster of lymph nodes that you can see in the right axilla, like almost a little grape cluster. He went ahead and had IR biopsy it, and it actually showed metastatic melanoma. In this case, the BRAF is positive. A dermatologist went through her entire physical body and really could not find the primary lesion. She went to the OR, got everything taken out. There was a nodal clump. Most of it is actually somewhat matted. And she received a year of BRAF-directed therapy. She got Ingobini and was surveyed serially and had lung mets. This was more than a year from the BRAF therapy, and she then subsequently received Ipi/Nivo and has done pretty well. At least currently she is in remission still, and she's on single agent nivolumab. She would not be considered a CR, so a very good PR.
So incidentally, it's funny, we have a fellow in the chat room who wants to know how he's supposed to answer on the boards. What comes first in metastatic BRAF mutant disease? Well, just, I don't know whether the boards is as up to date as our clinical research, but any thoughts about this case? And I'm kind of curious, would you have sent this patient for surgery or given neoadjuvant immunotherapy in this situation? Because that's what when I heard that case, I was like, I wonder if Georgina would use neoadjuvant.
Absolutely. If this came in now, obviously it's a historic case, but if it came in that patient like that came in now, I would discuss with her neoadjuvant therapy. Being younger and BRAF mutant, I'd be keen for combination. I'd try and get her on a trial. We did the Opacineo, the Prado trial. That was a collaboration between Melanoma Institute Australia and the Netherlands. And now we've got the Nadina phase 3. But yes, a BRAF mutant young patient, I'd be going for combination neoadjuvant Ipi/Nivo, and as I said before, we do the lower dose Ipi in that situation, although Ipi dose is important. So that's what I'd do for her, put her on a clinical trial. That case is really interesting. I think what Dr. Moon would do follows what we would do. She may have had a discussion about adjuvant immunotherapy, but it all depends the time era that that patient actually presented. In terms of no primary, we know that about 15 to 20% of stage 3 melanoma with lymphadenopathy have no primary that we can identify. Be interesting to pull out that in situ and see if it was actually regression. If you see a lot of T cells in regression, get a pathological review. But otherwise, look, the horse is bolted. She had stage 3 and now stage 4. That really doesn't make a difference. That would be an academic thing to do. All of the unknown primary patients with lymph node disease, when we look at the DNA, RNA and DNA of those lymph nodes, metastases, they are cutaneous. They've got a UV signature. So obviously the patient has had some primary at some point, we think, and it's just the immune system's dealt with the primary and then they're left with this clone that won't go away.
So I knew this was going to be one of the quickest hours we've ever gone through. It just flew right by. We didn't get through all the cases or all the data, but it was just so great to hear what you had to say here today. As always, Georgina, thank you so much. Audience, thank you for attending. Come back in a couple weeks on the 30th. We'll see what Dr. LaManna and Dr. Weirder have to say about BTK inhibitors and particularly toxicity issues. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Georgina.
Thank you so much, Neil. Take care. Great to be on.